Greetings and salutations, everyone. This is AC2GS. My name is Roy, Romeo Oscar Yankee. I am net control operator for this, the Limark Technical Net. We're here every Sunday night at 8 p.m., and it's another 8 p.m. and another Sunday night. And for observant people, I hope you had a good Easter. I hope you're enjoying your Easter, and I hope Easter hasn't interrupted your participation in the technical net tonight. So I will drop it for a second and tell you the usual links that I think you should be aware of. Okay, as always, if you cannot get directly to the repeater and talk to me on the radio, if you have any questions you'd like to ask, if you have any topics you'd like to hear covered, if you'd like to share a puzzle, we always like to share our puzzles with everyone, and it seems to go over reasonably well. So if you have one as well and you'd like to share it with me and through me the rest of the people at the TechNet, or if you'd like me to poke Paul on the shoulder and ask him to take a look at some space or NASA-related news item, a video, or what have you, then the email to contact me with is you just go and send it to mailbag@ac2gs.com. Again, mailbag at, my call sign is alphacharlie2gulfsierra.com, and that'll bring the email to me. Every week I put up a whole bunch of interesting links for different reasons. I have a series of articles that if I have a chance to get to them tonight as part of the science talk, if we don't have a chance, you'll have the links available. You can read the original articles that the stories are based on. There's a couple of nice illustrations that Paul has sent me that I'm sharing with you. Also, there are a bunch of interesting links in general that I found through the week. They go into all kinds of interesting subjects. So one is a very nice, very short dissertation on what Bitcoin is and how it actually works. There is another article from Nuts and Volts on a technology called a magnetic amplifier that doesn't use vacuum tubes or transistors. And a bunch of interesting links. So one of the links is a video compilation I made up. Hank, N1YDY, was discussing last Sunday about a British comedy show called Spitting Images, and they had done a bunch of episodes somewhat ridiculing Elon Musk and the other billionaires making space rockets and such. So I put them all together, and I put a link up. So if you're interested, please feel free. So that you can get to that by typing in roy.ac2gs.com, and that'll bring you to my link page. The chat room is available either going through Limark's own website and going through their link, or you can just type into your browser chat.ac2gs.com. And I do an audio stream, so people who don't have a radio, who can't get onto Echo Link, they can type technet.ac2gs.com. That'll give them the audio stream from the Internet. And I never forget, my KC2NJI has a wonderful archive of the technical net going all the way back to 2006.
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
Okay, I'm getting a little long-winded in my old age. Anyway, just quickly, mailbag@ac2gs.com is the mail. Roy.ac2gs.com is the link page. Chat.ac2gs is the chat room. Technet.ac2gs is the audio stream. And Mike KC2NJI has a wonderful archive of the technical nets going back to September of 2006. His website is amateurradio.tv. Let me drop 1 second, and I will tell you the plan for tonight. Okay, we will start, as always, by asking people with any questions or topics to check in. We will ask them for their first name and their call sign, We will write them down in order, and then we will try to answer their questions and ask for participants to help out as well. Unfortunately, tonight we will not have another episode edition of Andy's Corner. I hope that Andy will be returning next Sunday night with the next episode, which will be broadcast antennas. We'll go through questions and answers. We'll go through radio questions and answers. We'll go through science questions and answers. We'll go through science talk if we have time. And I have a couple of puzzles as well for you. Around 10:15 or so, I will call upon Paul, WS2N, to bring us the SpaceNet report. That will take us to approximately 11 p.m., in which I will return and tie a little bow on top and wish you well for the next week. So that's my hope and plan. We'll see if it works out. Does anyone want to put their name down for any questions tonight or any topics tonight? Please give me your first name and your call sign.
KC2DAW supporting the net.
Okay, thank you very much, Curtis. Anyone else want to put their name down for any questions or topics tonight? We're going to have a quiet night. It's Easter. Andy's not able to give us an Andy's Corner, so the more questions, the better.
WS2N.
Yes, Paul, you have a question or a topic tonight?
No, if anybody wants to see the space station go overhead, it's going to be in, 3 minutes. Probably one of the better passes of the year. Probably the brightest. It's very clear outside. So from 8:10, and that'll last about 6. So if you look to the northwest, it's going to seem that way. It's actually 75 above the horizon from the northwest to the southeast. I mean, it's going to be just perfect. You watch. Back to you, Roy.
KD2OGB.
Yes, Greg, you have a question for tonight?
Perhaps. Something computer wise. Who's at the top right now?
In terms of what?
In terms of questions or comments tonight, wondering. I can always wait.
Well, you're the first person with a question tonight. I'm still taking listings, so... if you rest up for a couple of minutes, and once I get through the listings, you're on the top of the list. So if anyone else out there would like to put their name on the list for tonight for any questions or topics of a technical nature, preferably radio technical nature at first, but we'll take any scientific discussion that anyone has for us. So please give me your first name and your call sign. Okay, Rich, you're on the list. Anyone else want to put their name on the list for tonight for any topics or questions?
This KC2DAW supporting the net.
Yes, Curtis, I recognized you, and I thank you for supporting the net. Anyone else want to put their name down for any questions or topics tonight?
KD2UQK.
Into my Bravo, Clemson, South Carolina. Checking into the net, as usual.
Okay, Rob recognized, and Barry, welcome back to the net. I'm glad to hear you. I hope things are going well for you in South Carolina. Anyone else with any questions for the net tonight, please give me your first name and your call sign. I mean, I'll be asking later on as well, because there's a lot of time to fill tonight. But if you think that you might have a question, give me your first name and your call sign, please. Okay, we'll start with the three that we have here. Craig, KD2OGB. What's your question for tonight, Craig?
Well, first, here is this super easy question for you. Does your computer have a thin CD drive, or is it external?
Well, I have more than one computer. I'm sure you have more than one computer. The one that I'm working on right now in my shack, and anyone who is curious what it might look like, you can take a look at most of it going to my QRZ page. I have a nice display. It's basically a tower. It has a built-in CD. It's a built-in DVD burner. It's going out of fashion. A lot of people are recommending people save their money, and if they find that they need it, they can always buy a USB portable version that they can go from computer to computer. But, you know, I mean, thankfully I don't have a floppy drive in my computer, but I thought it would be nice if I had a DVD burner. I hardly ever used it. A few times I actually used it, but few and far between.
Yeah, I'm thinking of moving over, and I'm going to get some. And I'm sure you know, but I'm an old thing, and I like your achievement. I purchased.
Craig, I don't know what's going on. As far as I could hear, you're dropping out of what I perceive as the receiver. You're on for a second or two. You're off for a second or two. You're on for a second or two. So I don't know exactly what's going on. Maybe it's a bad mic connection or something. So if you want to kind of take a quick look at your mic cord and make sure that it's nice and tightly connected into the connector that it's supposed to be. I can't understand you, Greg. Unfortunately, you're dropping out. I'm looking at your waveform both on the UHF link that I'm using to get in, and also Glen Oaks, and both of them are kind of showing me the same thing, that you're dropping in, out, and in and out again.
I'm on my V82 tonight. I don't have anything else out there because it's been a while since I last even made a charge, so I don't know if I can even make the best out of this.
Okay, well, that transmission was complete. There were no dropouts, so whatever you did this time, continue doing it.
All right. So as I was saying, in terms of CD drives, a lot of modern towers nowadays, if you're going to build a PC, are kind of obsolete. But I'm moving everything, I guess, to a new tower, and I have no problems getting an external CD drive. Now, in terms of a CD drive, something surprising happened, which I wasn't expecting to happen. And it had to do with a video game that actually worked with Windows 10, but it wouldn't install through the CD. I had to get it through Origin.
Okay, a little point of reference. Are you really talking about CD or are you talking about DVD? They have different capacities.
I believe it's a DVD ROM disc. Now, I actually bought it physically because I don't remember where my physical copies were, because back then we had something modified to make it work without the disc. And so it wouldn't install through the disk. It said Silic redundancy check, meaning the operating system can't read or write the data correctly, which can happen if the disk has damaged information or it's corrupt. It turns out, and the problem's already resolved, but it turns out you can actually get most of these disks now digitally through, like, Steam or Origin, and you can own it that way.
Okay, that's good to know. A lot of, almost all of the reasonably sized games are downloadable anyway. You know, Steam has made quite a good living of providing downloadable games and such. So that's one of the many reasons why DVDs are sort of a thing of the past, because everyone has a reasonably fast internet connection, and it's much easier to just pay with your credit card and have a server download the software instead of having to wait for the UPS guy bring you your DVD. And also the medium can be corrupted, as you mentioned. All it takes is a scratch in the wrong place, and the disc is useless.
Theoretically, you could just copy everything to a folder and install it that way, but I don't know if that's really good, since technically the discs contain mostly the installer, but they have various other things to install on top of it, because you're adding extra values on what you're normally installing, but at the same time, that's why the stuff you're installing is so huge.
Well, yeah, it depends upon what the manufacturer has in mind. In the old days, they put in bad sectors and software that recognized the bad sector, and so it was an anti-piracy measure. So there are some DVDs that you can't simply just slide into the hard drive and have them work because they're more devious than that. Others are designed in such a weird way that they have to be in your root directory. If they're in a subfolder, sometimes the script that installs them fails. So there are a bunch of different ways it could go wrong as well.
They say that installing stuff on an SSD or a boot drive perhaps makes them faster, but my boot drive is already half full, and I'm considering on upgrading it from 256 to 1 terabyte, but all of my games are on a separate hard drive, and all of my other stuff is on my main drive. My music has its own drive. It's all organized, and so that's how I typically organize stuff. But compare a 1 terabyte SSD. Just imagine what you can do with that one.
Well, yeah, the prices have gone down, although memory chips are getting problematic because of COVID-19, and a lot of manufacturers cut their order for silicon chips. So a lot of companies, including I think a couple of automobile companies, said that they're going to slow down their production purely because they don't have enough special proprietary chips for their technology. SSDs are wonderful things. They still cost more gigabit by gigabit than hard drive. Also, you have to understand that solid-state drives have a long but limited lifespan. They have only so many times that they can flip from 1 to 0 and such. So you can burn them out. So there are places where it is unwise to use an SSD. If it's a caching memory site where the memory is updated, multiple times a second, you're just going to burn through them. So you want somewhat stable data on your SSD, and operating systems are designed to understand that and go with that. But I love SSD. If you put your games on your SSD drive, you will notice a significant improvement in loading up the files, you know, because most games have these large graphics maps that load when you go from one region to another. So the difference between a hard drive with a SATA interface and a solid-state drive with an NVI, NV1, NV2 interface is dramatic. So if you got the money and you can upgrade it, that would be a nice thing. You'd probably enjoy the ride.
They say that SSDs, if you maintain them right, you could probably get like 10 years out of them with no problem. Unlike regular hard drives that probably don't last as long. And speaking of which, my sleep, so I'll be waking that up. They say that those probably would only last maybe like 4 to 6 years. They say that if you hear slight ticks inside of drives once in a while, that does signify it's about to go out.
Well, you have to understand, hard drives are electromechanical in nature. The mechanical actuators can fail. The read-write heads can fail. That's called the click of death. There are some cases where there's a mechanical flaw that sets in, and you start up the hard drive, and all you get is clicking and no data. It depends upon the duty cycle of your hard drive and the manufacturer and how the quality is different. Companies make different grades of hard drive that are sturdier than others. The ones that are built for servers or NASs are going to be a little bit sturdier, most likely, than ones built for just desktop computers. The problem is that with hard drives, it's mechanical wear and tear. So there's a motor, there's a stepper motor, there's all kinds of things that go clickety-clack inside of a hard drive. Solid-state drives, as the saying goes, is solid-state. It's all done electronically. There is no mechanical manipulation. And so it is purely, other than just component failure, it is purely a cause of flipping bits too frequently. Usually there's all kinds of interesting software built into the solid-state drives that will retire old blocks of memory if they've been used beyond a certain point and open up spare hidden memory to take its place. And as long as you don't take excessive caching and refreshing and changing of memory and you kind of age the cells too quickly, it should last you the lifespan of your computer. I had a SSD, unfortunately, that had a real weird firmware quirk that after a certain date, and it recognized the date, it stopped working. I had to look it up and find out that I had to reflash the firmware to get around that. But that's an unusual thing. I haven't heard anyone having that problem in years. But, yes, solid-state drives are loads of fun, but there are ways of aging them, unfortunately.
That's another reason why I'm probably going to upgrade, so I can get more time out of the computer. Because I still have my Windows 10 license CD someplace. I mean, even if I wanted to build a brand new computer from scratch, I mean, I can still use that and just copy all my mechanical drives, but just create new folders for the boot drive. It would be that easy. But yeah, I could probably move stuff from one SSD to another and then basically just scrap that one. I don't see how I can find that too difficult, so I've got plenty of tricks, and I'm going to ask a friend what they say about 1 terabyte versus 256. So that's what I've got for tonight. Time for me to hit the bed. I got to be in the hillside tomorrow morning, Roy, but thank you.
Well, you're welcome, Craig. According to my math, 1 terabyte is 4 times better than a 256 gigabyte solid-state drive. And I wish you good luck with it. This shouldn't be a problem. I wouldn't suggest to people out there that they go from an operating system that's based on a hard drive to just kind of copy it over to a solid-state drive. Because sometimes the configurations are slightly adjusted when you boot into a solid-state drive that takes advantage and benefits the solid-state. So I wouldn't just clone a hard drive to a solid-state drive, but it shouldn't be a problem cloning a small solid-state drive to a larger one.
Um, my computer had slowed down very, very slightly, but over time, I think that maybe getting a new motherboard might perhaps work. I mean, this motherboard that I've had is only, like, what, 2 years old? It's a Tough Gaming Asus motherboard. So perhaps maybe in another 2 years or 3 years, maybe I might look into another build. And I could actually still use existing parts, like my graphics card, or come up with something newer. So we'll see what happens. So that's all I've got for now, Roy. Thank you. AC2GS Net Control, KD2OGB.
Okay, very good. I wish you good luck. Unfortunately, the nature of computers, Phil, is good and bad, is that the CPUs will get better. It sort of depends at this point whether you've gone with Intel or AMD. AMD is kind of beating Intel up decisively. Intel might turn it around. They did it in the past. They'll probably do it in the future. And graphics cards will always improve as well. So in another 2 years, depending upon what graphics card you have now, if it's 2 years old, a four-year difference in a graphics card can make a significant difference. You might want to do some really ridiculous high-resolution anti-aliasing, ray tracing and such, and so you may want the latest and greatest graphics card. Graphics cards are at a real premium lately, again, because of the scarcity of silicon out there. All the wafers are being used for all kinds of things other than graphics cards and such. So I wish you good luck with that, Craig.
I can tell you, Intel and AMD are tech. So carry on, KD2OGB.
Okay, very good. Next on my list for tonight is Rich, W2BZ. What's your question or your topic tonight, Rich?
Couple of things, Roy. If there are any fans out there of William F. Buckley, I don't mean politically. I am not in his political camp, but I always used to love to listen to him. YouTube is being flooded with his old shows, and he's quite a character, quite somebody to listen to, very intelligent, again, no matter what side of the political spectrum you're on. So if anybody used to like to watch William F. Buckley, he's on all over the place on YouTube, just starting this week. Anyway, that's number one. Number two is I have to put up a tram vertical, and I was wondering, it has three ground planes, and I was wondering how important it is for those ground planes to be a certain distance off the ground, and how are they coupled to the ground, no matter how high they are off the ground, if you know what I mean. If they're 10 feet off the ground, if they're 3 feet off the ground, how do they work with the Earth in terms of that part of the antenna? Go ahead.
Well, they're capacitively coupled. The degree of capacitive coupling increases as you bring it closer to the ground. If you place it at the ground, you're not going to get a lot of good work with three radials. Ground radials, very often there's loads of articles of what the optimum number of ground radials. They tend to come up with either something in the high 20s to the mid 30s. Some people have tried things like chicken wire, where they just line the ground with chicken wire. The problem with that is when corrosion sets in, you have a bunch of nonlinear segments, nonlinear conducting junctions that can produce all kinds of harmonics and RF and such. So that's not a good idea. So if you're getting within a couple of feet to the ground, you're going to need a lot more than three radials. You got to lift the radials, and also it depends upon the wavelength. You don't have to lift it as high for shorter frequencies, shorter wavelengths. So if you're doing a UHF, VHF, you only have to raise it up, I'd say, about 6 feet, and you don't have to too much worry about the ground coupling. If you get a lot of ground coupling, you're going to be using a lot of RF to warm up your soil. Dick used to mention that it'll make the worms happy. So it's important that they're omnidirectional. If you have three of them, they should be pointed at, 360 by divided by 3, so 120 degrees each, because if you bunch them together in any particular place, it will be less omnidirectional and more located where you've placed those three ground planes. But the higher you are up, the less you have to worry about coupling, and the higher the frequency, the less you have to worry about ground coupling. Did I answer your question, Rich?
These radios are built in or screw in to the antenna, so it's not like, you could just string, I guess you can, string other wire, out from those, but basically they are three solid pieces of steel coming off the bottom of the antenna, as we've all seen on a commercial vertical. So I'll try to get them up 6 feet if I can, and see how that does. And I wonder if there's any other, are there any other factors other than height of the radios above the ground that matter much with an antenna of this type? Go ahead.
Well, with each given antenna, as the old saying, the three most important things about UHF, VHF antennas is elevation, elevation, and elevation. So the higher you can make it, the more it's going to be line of sight with places that you're interested in, the less likely it's going to have to go through buildings and steel shells and all kinds of water towers and what have you. So the higher, always the better. Theoretically, if you string together a bunch of antennas that are done in the GP3 and 6 and 9, and also that's Comet. Diamond also makes collinears. You'll increase the gain by flattening the pancake of the radiation pattern, and so you'll condense it to a sharp enough point that if it's able to kind of go line of sight to the antenna, it'll be much stronger than if it is much broader in elevation angles all over the place. So, but ultimately, it's a matter of proper height. Make sure that it's resonant, to make sure that everything is working the way it's supposed to, and then just try and put it in an unobstructed, relatively high location for optimum use.
Now, when you say unobstructed, are you talking about the tip of the antenna, the tip of the vertical, or are you talking about including the radials? The radials are pre-bent at a certain angle. Are you talking about those being unobstructed too? Because that's not going to happen. I don't have the wherewithal for that to happen, okay? But the tip of the vertical can well be unobstructed. Is that good enough for it?
Well, I wish I could tell you it is, but it isn't quite. As was mentioned a few times in Andy's Corner, you get your voltage maximum at the edge, but you get your current maximum at the feed point. And so a lot more current is being dispersed at the base of the vertical where the feed point is, and as it goes up the length of the vertical, less and less current is there. So most of the signal you'll find will be closer to the feed point. So raise it as high as you can. If you can't get it higher than that, then you can't get it higher than that. You know, life is always a compromise. But ultimately, when people talk about elevating a particular antenna, if you have a collinear, the collinears have separate feed points, one on top of another. So the highest of the segment's feed point, which is higher than the base of the antenna, gives you an additional height, which is also another benefit of things like collinears. But with a standard quarter-way vertical ground plane, it's the feed point.
Yeah, and the feed point is where the coax goes into the antenna. So, unfortunately, that's what I'm dealing with. We'll see. Maybe a miracle happens. Maybe by moving this thing the 3 or 4 feet, I have to move it. Maybe something good will happen in terms of Sheldon. But that's the question, and thanks for the answer. And I'll be sticking around for the rest of it. Thanks, Roy. W2DZ.
Okay, very good. Thanks for participating, Rich. Rob, KD2UQK, what's your question for tonight?
Well, hi, Roy. How you doing? KD2UQK, I got a question regarding, I was sideband on 2 meters. I was talking to a fellow on Simplex, and he said that at nighttime, I think it was 144.24, I believe, there was some 2 meter sideband activity. And he said, when he told me the frequency, he says it's horizontal. Now, is it regarding to the polarization of the signal, like it's literally horizontal, or is it something different? I don't quite know. Could you shed some light on that? And if I was going to receive it, obviously, I guess I couldn't receive it with a vertical. I would need a horizontal, as it were. Is that correct?
Okay, Rob. Yeah. For whatever reason, long-distance single sideband 2 meter work is done with an antenna polarized horizontally instead of vertically, and very common people use a Yagi type of configuration, which is more directable. So you know you get a little bit of extra gain. Theoretically, you could certainly rotate a Yagi 90 degrees and use it as a standard vertically or a polarized antenna for repeater work and FM simplex. But for whatever reason, everyone decided single sideband should be horizontally polarized. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean that you won't hear it. It will mean that there will be a significant loss in your ability to receive it. Theoretically, you know, the laws of physics were theoretical, you wouldn't hear it at all because it would be an infinite number of decibels down. Nothing really works like that. Antennas aren't perfectly linear. They tend to be actually a little elliptical. And so you would have a significant decibel loss trying to receive a local horizontally polarized transmission through a vertical antenna. It's not impossible. It's just somewhat impractical. So if you're interested in single sideband, you might want to consider getting something that can be turned into a horizontally polarized type of antenna.
Okay, I get you. Now, just for argument's sake, not that I would do it, but you can't just turn a vertical horizontal and call it a horizontal, right? You need some kind of other something going on. Obviously a Yagi or something to that effect.
Well, theoretically, if it's not too close to the ground, you can actually do that if you want. It's kind of mechanically problematic because it's gonna put all kinds of weird stresses on things. They're not actually going to be terribly mechanically balanced, but theoretically, if you have an elevated quarter wave a ground plane, and you rotate it 90 degrees, it should work as a passable horizontally polarized antenna. You know, just because we call the quarter wave a vertical doesn't necessarily mean that it can only be operated that way.
Okay, yeah, that makes some sense. Now, just clarify one thing for me. You said localized sideband transmissions. What do you consider localized? Is that within the tri-state area? Is that down the block? What do you mean by localized? Because the guy was talking about some of these guys using, he was talking to a guy in Connecticut. He said he used 700 watts going out. What's the frame of reference for sideband, for 2 meter sideband, I guess?
Well, that's a heck of a lot of power. There's basically two major ways that propagation occurs. It's ground wave and sky wave. A ground wave is line of sight, is ground waves themselves, is anything that's somewhat relatively close by. And in those cases, as long as you don't get too much reflections, your polarization angle doesn't change too much. Once you get into propagation in the ionosphere, there are some cases of tropospheric ducting that people use 2 meters. And in California, sometimes they converse with people in Hawaii using 2 meters the tropospheric ducting. That's going through it's not a true ionosphere, but it's a refractive layer that allows it to just kind of go much, much farther than it would ever go otherwise. And under those cases, there's something called Faraday rotation, which rotates the angle of the polarization. So you can have a guy at one end with a horizontally polarized antenna, and by the time it gets through the troposphere, it's rotated into the vertical position. So that's why I was kind of saying local with not too much reflection will maintain your polarization angle reasonably well. Once you get into the ionosphere and the troposphere, lots of luck. It could jump all over the place. It could bounce off the ground a few times. That introduces an interesting variation on what kind of polarization your transmission finally is perceived as.
Okay, I get what you're saying. All kinds of freaky stuff goes on when it hits the atmosphere. Okay, I understand you. All right, Roy, that's a very satisfying answer, as always. Thank you so much for doing that. KD2, UQK.
You're welcome, Rob. Thanks for participating in the TechNet. There was someone else who I didn't get their entire call sign. Can you repeat?
Hey, good evening. WE2QGZ with a couple notes on VHF sideband, if you're interested.
Yeah, sure.
Okay, so there's a lot of horizontal up in that part of the band, or down in that part of the band. If you're looking to try to squeeze by and do FM and sideband, if you put your antenna, Dick mentioned this a couple times, you can put your Yagi at a 45 or a 30 off a vertical, or, you know, 30 off horizontal, whatever you want to use. Wherever you want the most power, you know, favor that polarization a little bit, and you can make that work. With regard to Yagis, a lot of the higher gain, higher performance Yagis are relatively narrow in bandwidth and won't do the whole band, right? So some of the M squared products, you know, you're lucky to get 145 megahertz out of them, right? From 144, maybe 145 and a half. So you have to look very carefully at the antenna you're purchasing to make sure that you're getting something that covers the whole band. Let me drop. And the other issue is for verticals, right? You could just put up a horizontal dipole and that'll work fine. However, it'll be somewhat directional. Loops are kind of the antenna that's in favor for omnidirectional service there. I have two phase loops. They're at about 35 feet above the ground. I'm at about 35 feet of elevation. And as a result of the narrower noise power bandwidth and the bandwidth you're stuffing all your signal into versus FM, meaning 3 kilohertz of occupied signal full of noise to receive and putting all of your signal into 3 kilohertz of transmit bandwidth. It's not uncommon for me to go from Massapequa, where I am, down into South Jersey and Connecticut on a pretty regular basis. I can talk into New Hampshire also somewhat regularly, but there's a guy up there who's doing a lot of the heavy lifting on his end with lots of antennas and lots of power. So, how's that?
That's great. I appreciate it. The comment about the limited bandwidth, yeah, you were talking about 70 centimeters, because my experience with 2 meters generally is that the band itself isn't that wide. You can get away with a decent single antenna that that provides reasonable quality. But, you know, 70 centimeters can be a pain in the backside. So some people don't kind of realize that transverters and other things designed for 440 don't go, you know, down to the lower ends unless you ask for them. So, you know, people sort of think, I think, that 70 centimeters is like 2 meters. But I assume when you talked about the antenna bandwidth, it was primarily the 70 centimeter?
No, believe it or not, 2 meters VHF, right? Again, you can find some three-element Yagis made by folks that will do 144 to 148. However, some antennas don't. A lot of the EA antennas, they'll sell them for the whole band, but you have to set the elements. Sometimes they'll come with two sets of elements. A lot of the M squared products will come with two sets of elements, one for 146 to 148 and one for 144 to 146. So the higher performance Yagis for that band, you just have to pay close attention and make sure you're getting something that works over the whole band. I mean, the only high-performance Yagi I've seen, me personally, that did 144 to 148 was a Scala with it was like a hairpin balance match. It was a balance match. It wasn't a hairpin. It was some sort of balance match, and it was a really expensive antenna. So just look at what you're buying. Some work over the whole band or a significant portion of the band. My loops for 2 meters probably don't. I mean, I might squeeze 146 out of them if I was lucky, but that's about it.
Okay, very good. Thank you for that. I was unaware. I haven't done any real single sideband work on 2 meters. I had times where I was trying to order things for 70 centimeters, and I kept noticing that you get a distorted sense by the standard all-in-one transceiver that goes all from one end of 70 centimeters to another, but pretty much everything else, amplifiers, transverters, and certainly antennas, don't go that wide. So I was unaware that 2 meters had the same failing. So thanks for adding that to the discussion. I appreciate it.
Quick follow-up, Roy, UQK.
Yes, Rob.
Just in regards to the magnetic loop antennas, are those viable for transmitting through, or are they a receive-only kind of thing? Because I've seen guys use those with SDRs to get shortwave and, like, you know, broadcast shortwave and then various HF stuff. Are those viable to transmit with, or are they just a receive type of thing?
QGZ, I'm assuming that these are not magnetic loops you're talking about, but full wave loops.
I'm just waiting for some kind of beep here. Yeah, basically, it's sort of a dipole wrapped into a square, sort of. And what it does is it takes the bidirectional aspect of the dipole and makes it somewhat omni. So it's not a magnetic loop. They're pretty easy to make because you can fabricate them up out of a using a piece of coax or a improvised kind of gamma match to them. But the other thing is, it's not, kind of like you said earlier, right? There's stuff banging around all over the place, and multipath in this case is your friend. So just because you have a VHF, a vertical VHF antenna, if you want to pop up on one of the sideband channels and talk to folks, you'll certainly hear them. They'll hear you. You're not going to get the crazy DX when the band is open, but it's not going to stop you from talking or listening, especially because of all the multipath all over the place.
Okay, makes sense. Rob, I hope that makes sense to you. Magnetic loops for UHF and VHF are kind of okay as direction finders. I wouldn't really kind of use them for transmitters because the size of radiating antennas for 2 meters and 70 centimeters is small enough that you don't really need, in my opinion, to shrink them anymore and then futz around with high voltage protected vacuum capacitors or such to get a decent amount of watts through it. So magnetic loops are more directional finding receiving antennas at that frequency, in my opinion.
Okay, yeah, I'm sorry. I just watched a video on magnetic loops. I had a magnetic loop on the mind. I'm sorry about that. It's a dipole type of thing. I got you. All right, thank you, Roy. KD2 UQK.
Okay, thank you, Rob. Once again, I am AC2GS. My name is Roy Romeo Oscar Yankee, and this is the Limark Technical Net here every Sunday night at 8 p.m. We're sitting around here waiting for some questions or some topics of any kind of interest from people out there. So if you thought up of a question or you have a comment to make about radio technology or if not radio technology, any technology, just give me your first name and your call sign.
This is KD2UAH, Roy. Name is Rocco.
Yes, Rocco.
Question only, why is it that they don't really promote UHF, VHF antenna tuners so much? Because I've been doing some contacts, actually pretty good luck, on the 220 band with some people actually in the Staten Island repeater, and I got somebody actually in Jersey from Nassau County. Now, most of the antennas out there aren't really resonant for the 220 band. I have a CX333 Comet, which is supposed to do all three bands. Now, is there any benefit to getting an antenna tuner for that VHF band?
Well, as you mentioned, almost no one talks about these things. I actually own an MFJ 2-meter antenna tuner. It was one of my veiled attempts of dealing with a really awful antenna in a very awful position. I threw antenna tuners at it. I threw linear amplifiers at it, and it did not solve any of my problems. I eventually just had to lift it higher, and then I traded it in for a collinear design model that had an additional gain. Theoretically, it sort of depends upon what your VISWA is. If you measure your VISWA, and then you can look up what kind of energy you're losing from the reflections, it might pay to tweak it with an antenna tuner. Again, after my first attempt, I kind of put it in the closet and haven't looked at it again. Most people just suffer through the slight mismatches and deal with the attenuation losses. But if you want to borrow from someone an antenna tuner and fiddle around with it and see if you notice any benefit. The problem is that antenna tuners introduce their own losses. We had this endless discussion, me and Dick, that a perfect design for an antenna tuner can have very, 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 very little attenuation losses. The problem is that it would cost a lot of money and require a jet propulsion lab engineer to really design it. Most of the stuff out there is not that efficient. Matter of fact, I think it was QST this past month has an article on how to build a device to measure the amount of loss that you're getting from your antenna tuner. So it's one of those things where most people don't bother, but it might give you a marginal improvement, but I would be amazed if it gave you a dramatic one.
Roy, I just have a second kind of follow-up question. Now, on my 705, which obviously is QRP, I've been playing around. I have a Z100 plus tuner, and I don't have any room for any kind of long wire right here or maybe in my attic, but I've been playing around with the kind of the stick antennas, like the GRA, and the other one is made by Diamond. You know, basically you kind of snap the sections together with a coil with a wire, and no matter what I do with the Z100, I can't seem to get any kind of reasonable SWR where I can get any power out at all, even to try 10 meters or 6 meters. Well, what do you think I'm doing wrong? Back to you.
Well, you know, in a perfect world, I would tell you to pull out your little nano VNA and do a sweep of the antenna that you have so that you can assess what's going on. Does it have a resonance, or is it just kind of noisy and jumps all over the place? If it does have a resonance, or what's the impedance, what's the likely VSWR, the standing wave ratio at the frequency you're interested in? Unfortunately, not all antenna tuners are designed equally. There are different types. Antenna tuners are simply impedance matching devices, and there are different circuits that can do it to different degrees with different efficiencies and different costs for components. A PI network is a very good impedance matching circuit. It uses more components, so it's more expensive, so most places don't use them. The least expensive circuit used for impedance matching is an L circuit. It's just a capacitor and a inductor, and by switching in different inductances and different capacitance in an L type of a network, it matches the impedance. It's efficient. It's inexpensive because it has less total devices. It also has less range of correction. So it is possible that you simply cannot get your antenna into resonance because the mismatch is beyond the ability of your particular antenna tuner. Now, just to make things more complicated and confusing, just because your antenna tuner can't match it doesn't necessarily mean that there's not a way to get around it. If you change the length of coax going into your antenna tuner, in the transmission line that's not matched, your impedance will rotate as it goes down the transmission line, and its values will alter in a way that may or may not allow your tuning circuits to tune. As an example, I once had a problem where I had a 10-meter antenna that would not tune on my antenna tuner. I put in a 2-foot length of coax cable, and from that point on, the antenna tuner had no problem finding a setting where it tuned. So you also might want to consider putting a little jumper wire in the way and see if the universe is lucky for you.
It sounds to me like I might be better off trying the coax from the 705. I have that little holder bracket for it, so maybe I'll just put out a little bit of coax, and maybe I might be better off putting the antenna tuner right at the base of the antenna and not the radio. And also, maybe I would be better off getting one of those double needle, like the MFJ, the manual tuners, because that's more in price range that I can afford. Back to you.
Okay. You know, whatever you could afford. The difference between putting the antenna tuner closer to the feed point is that you'll get less insertion loss. In other words, if you put the antenna tuner at the shack, then you'll get a couple of reflections back and forth before that signal gets up to the antenna and radiates, and the added attenuation